Now's a good time to remember where the story of tequila started. In 1795, the first tequila distillery was opened by the Cuervo family. And 229 years later, Cuervo is still going strong. Family owned from the start, same family, same land. Now's a good time to enjoy Cuervo, the tequila that invented tequila. Go to Cuervo.com to shop tequila or visit a store near you. Cuervo, now's a good time.
Trademarks owned by Becle, SAB the CV, copyright 2024, Proximo, Jersey City, New Jersey. Please drink responsibly.
I love this confluence of events because Billy Corbin has been chronicling Miami being batshit crazy for a long time, and it is such fertile terrain for making content. And so now he's going to the well again here with just, hey, you want to know what the Miami 80s and 90s were like? You want to know the roots of where it is that my cocaine cowboy stories originate? Take us through it, Billy. How did you end up making this project for Netflix that I will imagine, because people love Narcos and they just love these drug stories, I imagine people will eat up how Miami weird all of this is.
Yeah, I may not be a one-hit wonder, but I might be a one-trick pony. Let's be perfectly honest about this. You know, back to the well.
You know, it's endlessly fascinating, though, Billy. Like, you could keep doing stories about Miami and drugs, and people will watch every last thing you do on Miami and drug stories.
Yeah, so this is our fourth title in the franchise. You know, we did Cocaine Cowboys. We did Cocaine Cowboys 2, Hustlin' with the Godmother. There's no G in that. It's Hustlin' with an apostrophe.
You're a little embarrassed by that, and I liked I didn't love the sellout of it, but I liked the story you were telling. I wish it had been in the first one, the story that was in the second one.
Listen, I was young and I needed the money. Let's be perfectly honest about it. It's the same reason, you know, I do porn, but like, you know, or I did porn. I was young and I needed the money, you know, but like, no, I'm not. We always have this conversation, you know, you and I. I think this is the first place that I sort of like confessed in real time and didn't necessarily mean to, like, that I was embarrassed, how I felt about broke and how I felt like we always have this therapy session about, you know, the projects that just, you know, don't quite turn out the way that you hope that they will. The intentions are good. I don't think you set out to make, nobody sets out, that's not true. Some people set out to make a bad movie, but they never set out to make a movie that's not for a particular audience, I think. And so, you know, we're lucky enough where there is a built-in audience, whether it's the drug content or the ESPN 30 for 30s in the case of Broke, but like, they don't always, the final product, when the final product strays so far from your original vision or what you had in your head going in, that those are the disappointments. And so I think that's only why I sort of...
Before you go too far down that path, I would simply say to you, you choose good subject matter. And it's right on the line of being a little bit pornography. And with some subtleties, it could be the great work that you've done. And if it falls a little to the other side of that, it can feel like you've somehow contaminated the art in a grab for money when that's not what you intended. You chose good subjects. In all of the instances in all of the movies you've made, I feel like you've chosen good subject matter.
I often quote you when you referred to the genre that we sort of semi-invented with the U, because it became a subgenre of 30 for 30. You called it sports porn. And that's, you know, that's, I think that's accurate. I say the job of a filmmaker, and this is true of probably any journalist or any storyteller, this is true of your job too. The goal is to find a good story and then don't fuck it up. You know, the PG version being find a good story and then tell it well, right? We do nonfiction stories. So we have to find a real story and real characters and real people who have a compelling story to tell. And then we have to come in and in our style and our filmmaking and our aesthetic, we have to support that story. So, yeah, you know, part of the obligation of making a documentary is that you need facts, you need journalism, but you're also creating a piece of pop culture. You're creating a piece of popular entertainment, hopefully, that people, and especially this project, Cocaine Cowboys, Kings of Miami, it's six parts. And if I'm going to ask an audience for that kind of time out of their lives, the story has to sustain it, and it has to be, let's say it has to be entertaining. They have to feel compelled to watch and continue to watch. That is our obligation. And so the term porn, I guess, comes into play when you address that. But I'm here to promote a thing, and I'm gonna lay down on the couch, Dan, if you don't mind.
In Miami, the subject matter you're choosing, drug use and just, it's ridiculous, Billy. I don't even know. Tell the people what this story is, because it's not even, the only link to your other cocaine-related stories is the cocaine.
And the title, of course. But yeah, this is an entirely new thing. You don't have to have seen any of the previous three Cocaine Cowboys, Cocaine Cowboys 2 Hustlin' with the Godmother, or Cocaine Cowboys Reloaded, which was a wholesale re-edit of the first movie from scratch with, I think, 60% new material that ran over 2.5 hours. Our other alternate title for Cocaine Cowboys Reloaded was Cocaine Cowboys : We Have Hours of This Shit. Which we did. I mean, we just had, you know, endless content of, and to your point about this era in Miami.
And people couldn't get enough of it.
Here's the thing. So you live in Miami, like I do, and you make Cocaine Cowboys, and people know you for that, or know me for that. And they will stop you in the street or at dinner and go, "Yo, bro, are you Billy Corbin?" And I'll go, "Are you a process server?" And they'll say no. And I'll go, "Then yes, now, yeah, I'm Billy Corbin." And they'll be like, "Bro, I love Cocaine Cowboys, bro. But like, you didn't get the whole story, bro. Cause you didn't interview my cousin, bro. My cousin knows all that shit, bro. Like, right? Like you can't do another Cocaine Cowboys until like you interview my uncle, bro. Like, holy shit, bro." I speak fluent West Kendall, by the way. I don't know if you know this, but like, so you have like, there is an obligation in a way to sort of serve your audience. And Miami is in part, Miami is the muse and Miami is the constituency, right? So, you know, the only reason we get to, I say the measure of a successful filmmaker is not money or awards or critical acclaim. It's that you get to work again. And if you continue to get to make more documentaries, you are a successful filmmaker. And the only reason I get to do that is because of Miami, is because, again, it's Miami in and it's Miami out, right? It's like, it's projects that are inspired by Miami, but then embraced by the audience in Miami. And so you have to serve, you know, your audience. I this was a labor of love, this project. It took us 12 years to make this project, but we don't make them for ourselves. We make them ultimately for an audience. So this, despite being the fourth title in the franchise, this is the first story we wanted to tell. This is the story that in the early zeros, the early 2000s, we set out to make a documentary called Cocaine Cowboys about Willie Falcone and Sal Magluta, who were Cuban exiles who dropped out of Miami High, appropriately, Miami High School, and became what the government alleged were the biggest cocaine traffickers in the history of the United States. They wound up in an indictment, which was the biggest drug trafficking case in the history of the federal government. 75 tons, over $2.1 billion with a B dollars of cocaine. And they were known, Willie Falcone and Sal Magluta, as Willie and Sal, Los Muchachos, the boys. And if you lived in Miami, that's how you knew them. The headlines read Willie and Sal. Nobody went, "Willie who? Sal who?" The chyrons in the upper left or right hand corner of the local news said Willie and Sal, not even Falcone and Magluta. And people knew, someone in the documentary says, you know, there may be 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, but in Miami, there's only 1 or 2 degrees of Willie and Sal. You either knew them or knew someone who knew them. Their tentacles and their money reached into sort of every facet of this community. And the trials that they went through, I mean, in that era, the average kind of career length of a cocaine trafficker in the United States, maybe 5 years. If you're like truly legendary and paying off the right people. Willie and Sal, for example, spent $1 million a month in payoffs. That was their monthly budget for political and law enforcement and criminal justice payoffs. They operated for 20 years.
The other Cocaine Cowboy stories were derivative of this one, right? All the other stories that you happened upon that you told in the time since you were trying to tell this original story. These guys are the godfathers of Miami, of the drug trade, exploiting market inefficiencies during that time. They helped build Miami in some ways, did they not?
I mean, they operated a multi-billion dollar multinational corporation, the primary product of which was illicit, was cocaine. But they had construction companies. They had an offshore powerboat racing team. They were world champions, I think 3 or 4 times over between the two teams. They had a boat manufacturing and boat engine business. They had a softball team, the Seahawks softball team, named for their offshore powerboat racing team, where they had a guy named Sergio Crego, who was a ringer, who they brought in from Canada and paid 30, 40, 50 grand per softball game. These are like local corporate softball leagues, but they had a guy that pitched 90 miles per hour underhanded.
So they
in a
can
softball
win.
League.
So they can so
they,
win.
And then brawl. They brawl on the field. We have a deleted scene coming out on Netflix's YouTube page with this softball team that could beat the Marlins any day of the week. I just realized as I was saying that, that's not saying very much. Nonetheless, it's true. And this guy also, incidentally, lived in a stash house where Willie and Sal kept cocaine when he came into town to play in these softball games. And they were known as kind of Robin Hoods because they would you'd go to Sal a la Don Corleone. And you'd say, I need my mortgage payment. I need rent. We're going to lose our house. My child is going to school and we need tuition money. And Sal would just give people money. And at the time when they were operating in the 80s, they were not known as a violent organization. They worked extraordinarily with both the Medellin and Cali cartels. They had a constant stream of supply of cocaine that they could bring into this country. First through Bimini and later through the West Coast, tractor trailers over the Mexican border. But they were able to operate. I think someone says they walked between the raindrops, which is really what the story is about. It's about the trials and the cat and mouse game that Willie and Sal played. But these guys, I don't know that you'll find anyone who's been in this country, particularly in the Cuban exile community, for any period of time who don't know who Willie and Sal are.
How crazy is this story?
The story is crazy. And the story is crazy also because most cocaine trafficking stories end when they get arrested. This story just begins when they get arrested like 6, 7, 8, 9 times over the course of the 6 episodes. Like they just keep getting arrested over and over and over again. It's just this revolving door where nothing seems to stick. Like I said, they're just walking between the raindrops, and you have the entire strength and power of the federal government, the DEA, the FBI, the IRS, the U.S. attorneys, the Department of Justice on these guys. And they spent on their first trial in 1995 into 96, they spent $25 million on their defense. That is between attorneys, private investigators. They had mock juries. They did they tested their case against. I mean, they just had an endless supply of money to go head to head. Really, in a way, they could match and really outmatch the resources of the federal government. People talk about the Dream Team and OJ. OJ did not spend a fraction of the money on his defense that these guys spent.
What are the craziest parts of the story?
Some of them are spoilers, because that's the thing. There's so many twists and turns in this story. I think the Miami Easter eggs in this are, like, ridiculous. They're ridiculous. Some of them we put a finer point on. That's just like, okay, you can't miss the Bee Gees, you can't miss the Miami Sound Machine. There's certain things that are very obvious. And then there's just things that kind of like blow by in passing, like a passing reference to Willie Chirino, to Latin American restaurant in Red Road, to like little, like just the map of Dade County just kind of illuminates in a really fun way that nobody else in the world will necessarily appreciate, but like it's just like a treasure trove for Miamians. And I think what's interesting about it and shocking about it, without trying to give away spoilers, is two things. First, the level of, I should say, multi-levels of the corruption, the entirety of the criminal justice system. One federal judge referred to Miami in the 80s as being on the ragged edge of anarchy. And so we had seen the biggest police corruption scandals in history, some of the biggest political corruption scandals in history. We saw judges corrupted. Law enforcement corrupted, attorneys corrupted, all as a result of drug money. Just the extraordinary influence of just this influx of drug money. I mean, I think Time magazine and the Paradise Lost cover, they said that the biggest industries, legit industries in Miami in the early 1980s were tourism, which was worth like $9 billion or $7 billion, and then real estate, which is worth as much as $12 billion. Drugs were estimated at between, they didn't know for sure, there's nobody, between 7 and 12 billion. So it would have made it potentially the single biggest industry in Miami at the time. And you had anywhere from 70 to 90% of the cocaine and marijuana coming into the United States coming in through Miami. So in the series, they corrupt an element of the criminal justice system that no one really predicted before, and at a level that was unprecedented, because Willie and Sal's tentacles reached out into this community in a way that very few people can do in a town of this size and could corrupt a federal trial at a level that no one could have ever conceived of.
The reporting that you have to do on this, the interviews that you have to get when you're talking to this many people about an insane time, was there a delight? Was there a danger? Were you getting too close to some things that people didn't want to talk about? Because this did escalate into becoming a very violent mafia industry.
They were accused of participating in these murders to protect themselves once their backs were against the wall and they were indicted, and they were looking at people in the organization, even family, flipping on them. The story did get dangerous. There is the fact is that, you know, a lot of this is people talking about the bad old good old days, or the good old bad old days in Miami. So a lot of this is stuff that happened some decades ago. The thing that's more compelling and potentially more dangerous about it that we address over the course of the series is that Willie and Sal had a lot of compromise on a lot of people in this community. And they had, there was a dossier, let's say, that contains lists of names by chapter and subject matter. They include people in the private sector, people in the public sector, people in law enforcement, who were knowingly participating or profiting from this massive cocaine trafficking conspiracy, who many of whom have never been identified today, many of whom may still be substantial members of the Miami community. They might even be still elected officials. They might even still be in law enforcement. Many of them have probably since retired or died, or maybe they were even busted for other, you know, other unrelated crimes. But those people are still out there. And while Willie and Sal and many of their associates have paid a price, as everyone does in these rise and fall stories, you always wind up dead or in prison. But there's a lot of people who didn't end up in either of those places. They profited greatly from the largesse of the cocaine traffickers. I think that Miami is, in the 1980s, during the cocaine boom, is the only successful real-world case study of Ronald Reagan's trickle-down economics, where it actually functioned, you could say that money came from the top, it stayed here in Miami, and found its way into nearly every single legitimate industry, and ultimately into the very foundation of an infrastructure of this community.
What are the great details of the excess that they were living?
Yeah, that's one of the fun things about doing a rise and fall story is you get to do the rise. You know, the fall is ugly. The thing about the movie is that if you're not going to binge all six episodes, what I'd recommend is it's really a trilogy of in two. So watch one and two, then watch three and four, then watch five and six. It's really a trilogy of feature docs in that way, structurally and tonally. You have the beginning, the middle, and the end. You know, you have your exposition, your conflict, and your resolution, the rise and the fall. And so getting to do the rise is obviously the fun part. The music is more fun. And that's the thing, too. The soundtrack is probably one of the greatest soundtracks we've ever done for a documentary in 20 years. You get to have the fun. You get to depict that lifestyle. You have every single offshore powerboat race that they participated in cost at least $1 million. That was just on boats and personnel. That didn't even include they flew in the entire extended family. They put them up. They live large. They bought meals. Then you have the mutiny, the scene at the mutiny back in the day, which we kind of touched upon in the first Cocaine Cowboys, which was this ridiculously lavish hotel in Coconut Grove. Overlooking Dinner Key Marina and the mooring sailboats in the inlet there. And they had a nightclub on the second floor of this hotel that was absolutely, someone refers to it as the Wall Street of the cocaine business in Miami. And these lavish themed rooms with just utter debauchery at all hours of the day and night. And Willie and Sal were card carrying members of the mutiny. You have vacation homes and mansions. You have condos everywhere. They had a condo in Brickell Key that they referred to as Scarface. That was kind of like the after party. They'd go to Club New, they'd go to the Mutiny, they'd go to Honey for the Bears or Suzanne's, and then they'd hit Scarface, which was the after party condo in Brickell Key. So there was they had a lot of fun at their peak. And you also have to remember, when they get busted in 91, they're like 34, 35 years old. They're on their mid-30s. So they lived a lot of life, you know, in their 20s and 30s. I mean, I think any of us would look back on our 20s and say, man, I did some crazy shit. These guys did some crazy shit in their 20s and early 30s.
So the summer's rolling in. The sun's out a little bit longer, which means we have more time to do the things that we like to do. Go out to the golf course, hit the beach, play some hoops outside. Anything you like to do. Miami's going to get hot. And you know what I like? A nice ice cold Miller Lite. And a lot's changed over the years, but one thing that hasn't is the great taste of Miller Lite. So what is the best thing about the original light beer? Miller Lite sparked this debate in 1975, and we still haven't settled it. It's the best light beer because it's crisp, refreshing, and it tastes the same. Great. Every single time. The consistency of Miller Lite, no matter where you get it, draft, bottle, can. Miller Lite keeps it simple, undebatable quality, great taste, and only 96 calories. It's the beer that strips away everything you don't need and holds on to what matters most. A light beer that actually tastes like beer. You don't have to choose what's best. Miller Lite has great taste and is less filling and always tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/beach. Or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces. Fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
How did they build it?
Sal Magluta came to the United States during Pedro Pan, during the freedom flights that a Catholic church had helped facilitate for parents who wanted their children to flee Cuba after the revolution, but couldn't necessarily leave themselves at that time. So you had this kind of, in a way, they're called freedom flights. It was beautiful, but this also very tragic scenario in which parents were putting their children. Sal was 5 or 6 years old, alone on a plane with a bunch of other children to come to this strange country. And if they were lucky, live with some distant relatives or extended family. Most of the kids were orphans, essentially, when they arrived here. And but Sal was lucky enough to have, you know, cousins and aunts and uncles to live in like a 1 or 2 bedroom, you know, dilapidated flat with one bathroom that this entire extended, I should say, multiple, you know, families shared. And was without his parents for about 4 or 5 years. And I think that was, I'm not making excuses. I'm explaining, you know, that immigrant experience in Miami at the time. And the parents of that generation, I think in a way, there was a generation of Miamians, by the way, Anglo and Cuban exile alike, who were almost kind of guilty by geography, you know, time and place. There was an opportunity. There was opportunities here for young people who thought they understood what the American dream was, right? This mythological thing where the streets are paved with gold, you become a millionaire overnight. And I think they thought that that's what this was. It was this kind of warped American dream story that they see their friends in Little Havana, in Hialeah, in Miami, becoming millionaires overnight. Their parents, meanwhile, came over losing everything, losing their country, losing their money, losing their businesses, losing their property. They come to Miami with nothing. Sal's parents opened a bakery next to a Publix in a strip mall in Southwest Miami-Dade. It was a kosher Cuban bakery because they catered to a lot of synagogues back when there was a larger Jewish population in Miami. And they worked in that bakery for like 40 years. The government never took their house because they bought their house with their money. They worked with their hands before dawn every single day. Sal's generation maybe had a, you know, these first generation immigrants, exiles had a different, maybe again, time and place. They're looking around and their peers are at first selling nickel and dime bags, right? They're selling weed in high school. Not an uncommon thing. Then the business starts to move because there's more money. I mean, cocaine was worth more than gold. I mean, a kilo of cocaine wholesale was like $40,000, $50,000 in Miami back at that time, wholesale. And so they wanted to grow their business, but they didn't have enough cash is the bottom line. They were kids selling, buying grams, you know, divvying them up and kind of selling them in tiny little quantities. And then they had a friend, George Valdez, whose parents were best friends with Sal's parents from Cuba, which is how a lot of, you know, relationships, which is how community here started. It's the reason why that the Colombians, when they first came over, which we see in the first Cocaine Cowboys, could not adapt to this environment as quickly. They relied on the Cuban Americans who had a city within a city, who had a community here and people they could trust and rely on. And you say, stay in this house and don't look in the closet. And you could find people who would trust you, who you could trust to do that. Marco Rubio lived in a cocaine stash house for an entire summer. It was his brother-in-law's cocaine stash house in Kendall back when he was like 12, 13, 14 years old. That's not an indictment of Marco Rubio. That's more like a Miami rite of passage. That's like a bar mitzvah, you know, in Miami. You're spending the summer in your brother-in-law's cocaine stash house in Kendall, you know. So it was just kind of a way of life for in a time and place in Miami. And it's a unique family story in that way. Whereas the first Cocaine Cowboys feels a little bit wild, wild west. This feels like Miami. It feels like Little Havana. It feels like, and everybody I met in this project were just like normal families. They were just like normal Miami people, some of whom found themselves obviously way in over their head, but they were just like kind of cool people. I mean, Sal, so when we first started this project, we've been working on this for 12 years. Okay, 12 años, and super long. And we started it when Marilyn Bonachea, Sal's childhood sweetheart, later his mistress and bookkeeper, his girlfriend, like lifelong girlfriend, since she worked in his parents' bakery, actually. She came out of witness protection and reached out to us shortly thereafter, and we got that interview in the can, which I think is to me, the most important interview and the most compelling interview.
Why did she reach out to you?
I don't know. I think because she had seen Cocaine Cowboys and she knew we were doing these types of stories. I think she had, you know, she had lost track of her family at that point in witness protection. She knew where her son was, but she didn't know where her parents were. She didn't know if they were alive or dead. I think she was looking for a way to kind of get out there and tell her story and maybe help her to find her family. But also she had been alone, you know, in witness protection, kind of just stewing in her thoughts. And she came out with little more than her story, which was a compelling one and worth telling. She was right. Alfred Spellman, my producing partner, often jokes that when people get out of prison in Florida, their first call is to their mother and their second call is to us to make a documentary. That wasn't quite the case here, but she was just putting out feelers, I think. And I also, Alfred and I had done an interview with Ocean Drive magazine where we identified the Willie and Sal story as being a bucket list project for us. And it turns out that Sal Magluta is subscribed to Ocean Drive magazine in federal prison. And he read this article and through friends and family reached out to me and gave me access to his personal archive, invited me to his parents' house. His mother made me cafecito, fed me pastelitos, and we talked and we went through their photo albums from Cuba.
Why? Why did he do this?
I think he wanted somebody to tell the story. And I think because of our enthusiasm and our passion for it, this is a passion project that he trusted us to do it. And I wound up years later in his personal private storage unit with 20 plus years of materials, videos, documents, some probably attorney-client privileged documents, audio tapes, trial exhibits, photos. And that's how this...
You must have found that fascinating, like if you fell upon a treasure chest, no?
You know, some projects begin that way. You mean like, oh, we found something. Now we have the means and the tools to tell this story. This happened when we were in the middle of it, really closer to the end, where I'm trying to figure out, like, I have all these interviews, make a hell of a podcast, how are we going to do this visually? What is the audience going to be seeing that corroborates the crazy shit that these folks are talking about? And we had a little bit of it, but not nearly enough of it. So for me, it was like a relief. You know, it was like we had invested so much into some archaeological dig and had turned up very little for years and years. And suddenly it was like, the mother load. We now, you know, and Sal gave us that key, no pun intended, to the castle there.
I don't know if you finished the Sal portion of the story, but my question was, how did this happen? And you haven't gotten to the Willie part.
Yeah, well, they met each other, I think in Miami, probably before Miami High. They were kind of childhood friends. I don't believe they knew each other or their families knew each other from Cuba. I think they connected in Miami, started selling marijuana, and then shifted into tiny, I don't even mean street dealer, I mean like high school dealer, like low level quantities of cocaine. But they started to kind of mingle in communities where people were interested in the product. And Miami was a sleepy town. There wasn't a lot of nightclubs just yet. There wasn't nightlife in general. It was, you know, Ocean Drive here was still God's waiting room. It was a lot of...
They're responsible for nightlife in Miami?
No, they are responsible. Someone gives them credit for discovering slash inventing the local, like, wholesale and retail cocaine trade. This was always a transshipment point, but it would go to New York, it would go to L.A., it would go to big cities with nightlife, with money, you know, with industry. Miami was a pretty depressed town in the 1970s, and there wasn't indigenous industry. There wasn't a lot of money. Tourism had dried up thanks to the advent of jet travel, which enabled people to take more exotic beach locations out of the country and go to the Bahamas and elsewhere. And thanks to Uncle Walt opening Disney World in the middle of the state in the 1970s, which basically was a dragnet. The Griswolds, or anybody, you know, who in their station wagon heading south to Miami Beach like they used to do every summer, were suddenly getting netted in Orlando and spending all their money there and never making it down here. So Miami was depressed at that time. And Willie and Sal started to find people. Young people and people with money, professionals, because it was a weekend warrior kind of a drug. You know, it wasn't this thing where you sit like heroin. It wasn't this sort of like antisocial thing. You sit in a corner or on a stoop and you just, you know, you shoot up. It was a party drug. So doctors and lawyers and professionals and people with money would go to their jobs during the week, and then the weekend they'd party and they'd do cocaine. So they helped to sort of invent and discover that market. And this, there was a guy that they knew, George Valdez. I was saying Sal watched George Valdez, who was an educated guy, went to the University of Miami, was working as an accountant, got a job at the Federal Reserve Bank here in Miami, and he met some interesting characters from Colombia. And the next thing you know, Sal notices he starts a banana company, and he's importing bananas on giant shipping, you know, containers from Colombia to Miami. And then he notices that George is making about $1 million a month. And I think the line is like, that's not from bananas. These are, you know, those aren't bananas that he's bringing in. And so Sal asks for a meeting, and Sal says, listen, I know what you're doing. Can you, you know, front me a kilo? And he's like, how much cash do you have? And he's like, I got like $8,000. And he just laughs. He's like, you know, he's like, I love Sal. He goes, but I didn't want to embarrass him. He goes, but you know, wholesale is going for $40,000-$45,000. He goes, he's like, listen, I'm all committed. My pieces, my product is all committed. You know, come back, you know, some other time. So George is about to leave the country, and he's got 40 kilos that was supposed to go to a wholesaler, to a supplier, that it fell, the deal fell through. The guy wasn't coming to get these 40 kilos. So he goes, I'm leaving the country. I'm not going to leave these 40 kilos sitting around. He calls up Sal. He says, listen, this is your moment. I got 40 kilos. I'm not giving you one, I'm not giving you 10, I'm not giving you 20. You take all 40 on consignment, and you know, come back to me in a month or two, you know, whatever you need, and you see what you can do. Within weeks, they came back with all the cash, Willie and Sal. And Sal was not confident in it. Willie was. Sal was the CEO. You know, he was the guy keeping the books, and he kept extensive and detailed ledgers of every single transaction, legit and illegitimate. And he knew where every kilo was, where every dollar was. Willie was the front man. He was the, like, you know, the face of the operation.
But what
the
kind of risk are they running right there when you take 40 kilos of cocaine on consignment? You're risking, that's a life and death transaction, is it not?
Yeah, but these are family friends from Cuba. So, you know, cocaine was a consignment business because it was so expensive. Weed, you'd pay cash for. But it was bulky and it was like low margin and everybody had it. And so cocaine was a rare commodity, and for the scarcity and the purity, you could get top dollar wholesale and retail for it. And this was a product that if you were buying it in Colombia, you were buying it maybe for $5,000 a kilo. Once you got it to the United States, that was the major risk, obviously, was the transshipment and getting it here. Then you're getting, like I said, wholesale 40, those margins are outrageous, you know.
So, Billy, are you giving these two guys credit for sort of starting cocaine trafficking in a big way in this city, building the nightlife in this city? Are you fertilizing seeds here, saying that these two guys are basically responsible for what it is Miami became?
In no small part, and people like them. I think that was the thesis of the original Cocaine Cowboys. You know, we wanted to say that the narco dollars generated in this community in that era built the city that we know and love and other people love to hate today. And I think that, and we did that because we couldn't tell the Willie and Sal story at that time. We did that with what I call a mosaic. We got different people. We got a different cocaine smuggler and different wholesaler, a hitman for Griselda Blanco, La Madrina, the godmother, Jorge Rivialla. We got lawyers. We got people, you know, journalists. We got law enforcement, a cross-section of people in Miami, each one a different tile, right, in this mosaic that when you backed up and zoomed out at the end was the skyline, was the city of Miami. And so we originally wanted to, with that same thesis, use Willie and Sal's story as the vessel through which to tell that, because to us, that is the ultimate story. So this was what we always wanted to do. And so the short answer to your question is too late, obviously, but is yes, that to some extent, I don't know if you want to call it credit, but to some extent, and you could call it blame even, they helped build these were guys who were, they were billionaires with a B. There's no doubt about it. And they were extremely generous. And so a lot of that money wound up in the community. It wound up in legitimate businesses, and it very much helped to build Miami.
And they got away with it again and again because everything was corrupt.
Because everything was corrupt, and they were so well-liked. They were so respected. Before they were feared, they were beloved. They were folk heroes. They someone refers to them as Robin Hoods. And so that was really, it was, I think they tempted the bees with honey and with cash.
Criminal heroes the same way Pablo Escobar was in Colombia, correct?
Very much the model. Very much the model. And I think that Miami, being America's Casablanca, is susceptible to that kind of influence. We have no indigenous industry. We have a transient population and lack of institutional memory. And so you have opportunities here where we subsist from hustle to hustle. You know, Tech Hub is just the new cocaine. That's all it is. It's all ultimately just a real estate hustle. We don't have any other business other than to attract tomorrow's tourists, right? Or tomorrow's new real estate buyers.
Were they Ray Liotta in a panicked frenzy in Goodfellas, just sort of hiding from helicopters all the time? Like, how intense did the scrutiny become?
No, one of the cops towards the end of episode one, it's hard to do this without spoilers, but one of the cops who was pursuing them early on said he gets Sal, finds him. Sal's got IDs and credit cards and some other name. No, I'm not Sal Magluta. Look, I'm this guy, you know. He had like drawers full of IDs and credit cards and passports, in fact, in different names. And so he gets him in the car after Sal denies, I'm not this guy. I mean, you made a mistake. Finally, you're driving to bring him to jail. And he says, okay, you got me. It's me. I could take you right now to a stash house with 1,000 kilos of cocaine in it. And you can have it if you let me go. And he doesn't care if they bust it, like, meaning like they make a big drug bust or they just keep it themselves. You know what 1,000 kilos of cocaine is worth to a cop in Miami in the late 1980s? So the cops describes him as saying he had absolutely no fear whatsoever of losing his freedom or his liberty. And he said, it didn't compute with me in that moment what that meant, that fearlessness and how dangerous that made him, just in terms of it didn't matter if he was going to jail that day. He wasn't going to be there for long. And he was right. He was absolutely right about that. And so I don't think that they lived like Ray Liotta. They were not looking over their shoulder. They were moving full steam ahead.
How did they become that fearless? They just knew they were that insulated by that they were running Miami.
It's like the broke story. It's like the athlete stories. You're a billionaire in your 20s. You're fucking invincible. Nobody can tell you anything. Nobody can convince you of anything. Nobody can say, like, you know, you're going to have a career-ending injury tomorrow and all of this is gone. They don't want to hear it. They don't believe it. So I think it's the same thing. These guys are the kings of Miami and no one could tell them. And, you know, tomorrow you could just law enforcement just knock on the door and that'll be the end of all of this. And they just, and they were, you know, I don't want to say they were adrenaline junkies, but they were offshore powerboat racers. Like, that's a very dangerous sport. You know, and they were champions in it. And so we have some in episode one, particularly, like I said, the rise is always more fun to make than the fall is. But we have some footage of their, you know, their races and interviews with them. You get to hear from them in interview, you know, these archive interviews from the boat races. And we kind of I don't want to say use it out of context, but like they're talking about the offshore paraboat racing business and how dangerous and fun and the speed. And sometimes you hit some bumpy waters. But so all of that metaphor kind of like carries over, and we intercut it with the drug running side of their, you know, smuggling side of their lives. But I think it's in addition to being kind of fun, it also offers you some insight into their mentality. And you know, Jim DeFede in his cover stories for the Miami New Times, I mean, he's the only one who covered this in any extensive feature story kind of way, attended the entirety of the first trial, et cetera. You know, Jim's, you know, their title was The Adventures of Willie and Sal, and like the continuing adventures of Willie and Sal, because that's really what they may have been, misadventures, but that was very much the, you know, the attitude, is that these were somehow pirates and adventurers.
How cutthroat and violent did they become?
Depends on who you ask, because, you know, the way it shakes out in the court system, again, I don't want to spoil it, but, you know, a jury would have you believe not at all. What was alleged was some pretty extraordinary shit. Not the least of which, my man, all these spoilers, but at the end, you discover that when they get arrested and they start to compile a potential witness list, who might be, where are the weak links in the organization, right? Who might flip on them and testify against them, jump on the bus, as they say. They started to make a list. So they took this internal defense list, right? And they decided that they were going to take out an ad in Prison Life magazine with this potential witness list and say, hey, listen, we're doing research on these. You know, we want to know about their criminal history, their background, their personal lives, whatever info you have on these men and women, let us know, because they might be witnesses in our case. You're looking at it the way the prosecution thought of it. The criminal defense attorneys, who we interview, they're like, well, that is our, we have a constitutional obligation and legal obligation to rigorously defend our clients. And you know, these are the people testifying against them are criminals themselves, and we need to learn about their history. In actuality, the defense of Willie and Sal knew more about the government's witnesses than the government did. Okay. You learn that too in the doc, but they created what the government referred to as a hit list, because many of the people on that list were themselves incarcerated, some in protective custody, some not. Believe you me, they were in protective custody very shortly after that that ad came out. But no one had ever seen anything like that before. That was some straight up gangster shit. And we talk about that. And then in point of fact, witnesses, potential witnesses and co-conspirators began dying, and not of natural causes.
How reckless were they? What are some examples you can give me of them just being out of control, reckless, beyond the pale on adrenaline junkies and powerboat champions?
I hate to bring it back to the powerboat racing thing, but that was on national television. That was a televised sporting event. It's hard to think of now, but that was big. You look at Miami Vice. That was a legit big sport. Now, mind you, more than 50%, I believe, of the champions, the world champions in that sport, were drug smugglers, were either convicted drug smugglers or later would be convicted drug smugglers. I'll give you a second. So they, the government comes into Miami. It's out of control. The drug smuggling is out of control. The violence starts to spill over into the streets. And Vice President at the time, George H.W. Bush, comes to town and is going to crack down the vice presidential task force on drugs in South Florida.
Massacres in the street. Like, you're talking about just gunfire, spraying, and people being dead in a parking lot because some sort of drug war has broken out regionally.
Miami was the murder capital of the United States of America in the early 1980s, and got worse every single year. 78, 79, 80, 81. I think it peaked in 82. And so people in this community had had enough. Truth be told, if the violence had not spilled over in such a public way and collateral damage hadn't started, it's possible the drug trade would have just been allowed to kind of continue unabated, because everybody was addicted to the money. It was the violence endangering men and women and children at the Dayland shopping mall at high noon on a summer's day that was suddenly problematic, and rightfully so. So they come into crackdown, and it's what the DEA calls the water balloon effect. You squeeze one side and the other side blows up. So they squeeze Miami in the Caribbean as an interdiction point, a transshipment point, and then everybody goes west. They say, okay, now we need to deal in the Mexican border. And Willie and Sal, in fact, move the operation. They were down to like 400 kilos in Miami, and they had no idea if there was going to be any more coming in, you know, through the Caribbean. And so they had to make it last. They spent, this is another deleted scene. They spent like the weekend in a house, you know, with the ether, just like stepping on this cocaine to make that 400 kilos into 800 or 1,000 kilos, you know, where they would repackage it with God knows what, baby powder and who knows. And the whole neighborhood was complaining because the ether, they could smell the ether and the cocaine all over this neighborhood in Westchester, near FIU. And so they move out west. They lived in Marina Del Rey outside of, you know, in Los Angeles County. And they were bringing up 18-wheelers filled with onions and thousands of kilos of cocaine that they would put behind, of course, the onions, so that when the dog came in or they would search, they'd be like, oh, fuck, these are onions. Like, go ahead. And so bringing it up through the Mexican border. And so they were in Marina Del Rey and they get busted. And some dumb shit. There's a couple kilos or some cash, no big deal. But they get busted under one of their litany of pseudonyms and fake names and fake IDs, like Sergio Mendo. What was it? Sergio something. Sal was. They get arrested, they bond out, and they go to Miami. Never AWOL, like never to be seen or heard from again in LA County. They're just like, okay, like that's it. They're looking for Sergio whoever, and I'm Sal McGlued in Miami. And so the LA County sheriff's deputy is watching TV one day after they go fugitive, after they realize these guys aren't showing, they're going to forfeit the bond. They don't give a shit. They're not showing up for hearings or for trial. They're gone. They're in the wind. And he's watching like ESPN one day. And sure as shit, who's being interviewed? But Sal Magluta. And he goes, that's not Sal Magluta. That's Sergio, what's his face? Who I busted, you know, last year. And there he is on national television. Knowing he's a fugitive in L.A., at that point, he was also a fugitive in Miami, giving an interview on national television.
On ESPN?
Yeah. Why not?
About sports? Just
About offshore powerboat racing. They were on a dock at a marina interviewing him about an offshore powerboat boat racing. And so that was pretty, you asked for reckless or wild. That's pretty fucking wild. That's only episode one. So there's five more episodes after.
How did it come out as a project? How do you feel about it based on the original intent 12 years ago? Did you end up making the movie that you always aspired to make? Oh. You probably guessed that at the time you were probably making a 2-hour movie. Now you got to make a 10-hour movie, right?
Well, that's a funny thing. This is a little inside baseball, but when we started to make it, we started accumulating interviews. We get access. We put this, when I say it's a labor of love, I mean like we had paying gigs, and then whenever we could have some money, we would like film interviews with people. And what we started to accumulate was basically, you know, an archive of interviews with people involved in this case. And so what we quickly realized was that we had too much material. The story was too big to tell in a one-off feature doc in 2 hours. Here's the thing. There was no such thing as a documentary series. It just didn't exist. You were either making a one-off 2-hour feature doc, or you were doing like American Greed, right? You were doing like 100,000 episodes, you know, of a show. There was no, like, other than Ken Burns, but he's his own genre. He can, you know, he does what he does, and no one can touch him. So like we couldn't sell a 10-hour documentary or an 8-hour documentary. And then there was a 1-2 punch. There was The Jinx on HBO, and then there was Making a Murderer on Netflix. And suddenly we had worked on this documentary so long, the business model we needed to tell the story was invented. And then we were like, shit, we can do a 6-part documentary. And, you know, and we did.
Last question. You mentioned the music and you mentioned this being a great soundtrack. Can you tell us of how it is that you lured, is there a good story, how you lured Armando into the tent?
Yeah, there is a good story. And so Pitbull was one of the first, like, we'll call them celebrity fans of the original Cocaine Cowboys back in 06, who got it on bootleg from like the Carol Mart, you know, the flea market in Miami Gardens in Carol City, and like started to talk it up. Like tell people, it went viral before viral was a thing. Like people trading DVDRs of it around, you know, Pharrell, Janet Jackson, all on bootleg. It was nuts. And Nori, DJ Khaled, but Pitbull was like literally one of the first guys. And he was always like, if I can ever do anything for you, please let me know. He showed up to the premiere, I think, of both of them, or the second one rather, Cocaine Cowboys 2, at the Colony Theater on Lincoln Road in Miami Beach. And at some point, we were looking to do kind of a, what they did for the 25th anniversary of Scarface is Def Jam Records put out like a hip hop album of songs inspired by Scarface. So we had a thought that we would do something like that and maybe put them in one of the documentaries, maybe Cocaine Cowboys Reloaded, which was originally called Cocaine Cowboys Remix. So we started, our composers at the time started to send out some tracks to some artists and say like, hey, if you want to rap to this, like, please, you know, do it. Only one person sent back a track. And that was Pit. That was Pitbull. And I heard it and I was like, holy shit. It's because it's like OG Pitbull, you know, it's like, it's pretty hardcore. And so like, and it's really genius. He like raps about cocaine in the first person as if he is cocaine. And so at that moment in time, we didn't really have a home for it because it was so like, it wasn't like something you'd throw on in the background of a scene. It was the star of the show. And so I'm like, where do you, we don't really have that kind of real estate in the docs. They're so, you know, they're so talky and so propulsive. Like, where would we like stop and do like this great song? And like, it just never happened. And then we start working on the Kings of Miami. And it's like, and again, it's like a Miami Cuban, you know, crime family saga. And I'm like, oh, I know what the theme song is. It's that Pitbull song. And I don't even think Alfred remembered it. I played it for him. He goes, holy shit. Well, that's the theme song. Because also you see these true crime documentary series and a lot of the theme songs are just kind of like,
I just love that Pitbull's doing it. Is it something that you own? The reason that I asked the question.
No.
I want to play it for the audience.
Oh.
I just want to be able to end the episode.
Text him. Ask him.
I want to just play at the end of this episode.
Text
him. The Pitbull
ask
song.
I will say, I feel like every, so we would be sitting in the editing room, you know, for years. And I'm just like, every time, so there was a couple of pictures that would come up and I'd be like, why is Dan Lebatard in this documentary? I'd be like, why is Dan Lebatard in this? Like
a
in his Quince.
Dan Lebatard, you are showing me
in his Quince,
a young Dan Lebatard with a mustache. Way more mustache than I had at 15.
And here you are at a Quince here. That's you and you're in the white, in the classic white suit, you know. And I was like, wow, I was like Sal kind of looks like.
If my life had gone a different way, if Boppy was somebody who somehow had a lot of drug running friends, I might have done it totally differently.
You are the new Kings of Miami.
Billy, thank you. I'm excited to watch this. Thank you for spending this time with us. People should watch what it is that he's doing because it's rich, it's vibrant, and it is distinctly Miami.
Thank you, Dan.
So the summer's rolling in. The sun's out a little bit longer, which means we have more time to do the things that we like to do. Go out to the golf course, hit the beach, play some hoops outside. Anything you like to do. Miami's going to get hot. And you know what I like? A nice ice cold Miller Lite. And a lot's changed over the years, but one thing that hasn't is the great taste of Miller Lite. So what is the best thing about the original light beer? Miller Lite sparked this debate in 1975, and we still haven't settled it. It's the best light beer because it's crisp, refreshing, and it tastes the same. Great. Every single time. The consistency of Miller Lite, no matter where you get it. Draft, bottle, can. Miller Lite keeps it simple, undebatable quality, great taste, and only 96 calories. It's the beer that strips away everything you don't need and holds on to what matters most. A light beer that actually tastes like beer. You don't have to choose what's best. Miller Lite has great taste and is less filling and always tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/beach. Or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces. Fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.